Heart of the Matter is brought to you by Dundalk Christian Counselling Centre. This free counselling service is situated at Dundalk Baptist Centre on RT Terrace. You can contact us in complete confidence on 932 7094 or email us at christiancounselling@aircom.net. You can also visit our website at dundalkbaptistchurch.org/counselling.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Heart of the Matter on Dundalk FM 97.7. My name is Michael Amati. I will be joined by Kevin here shortly, and I'll also be joined by another guest in just a moment, and his name is Doug Van Dorn. He's written a book on the book of Galatians, and we're going to be interviewing him and talking about what is this book about and what can we learn from this book that Paul has written. But before we get to that interview, we want to start with a song by Matt Redman, called 10,000 Reasons. It's a new day dawn. It's time to sing your song again. Whatever may pass and whatever lies before me, let me be singing when the evening comes. Bless the Well, Doug, let me again thank you for joining us here today and talking about your Galatians book. Right now on the program, we're actually going through the book of Galatians, and so that's why I thought it would be really interesting to bring you on, as I've been using your book to study and to prepare for this these programs. But can you tell us just really quickly how this book came about?
I preached through Galatians. I don't know. It's probably been six or seven years ago, I suppose. Mm. And so I manuscripted out all my sermons, and there was interest in me putting these together for a book. So that's what I just decided to do, is just take what I had preached and put them down for people to be able to read them. So,
okay, great. Great. Can you start us off by telling us what is the overall argument Paul is trying to make in the book of Galatians?
Well, there's this group of people that are in modern day Turkey that have become Christians. And there were, you know, in most of the churches that he went to, he had a mixture of Jews and Gentiles. So most of the, you know, the natives that are there are going to be the Gentile Christians. But because the Jews are scattered around the world in, you know, the times of the persecutions and things like that when James was written, and Galatians isn't too far away from that point in time, mm-hmm. These Jews were, you know, converting, and that there seems to have been, you know, a large number of the rabbis, kind of the priests that had been scattered around as well. I think this is kind of what the book of Hebrews is about as well. Mm. And anyway, they seem to have had a pretty difficult time losing some parts of, I guess, the ceremonial aspects of what it meant to be a national Jew. And so they started foisting this on the Gentile Christians, especially the idea of circumcising their kids. And this seemed to have been working together with some sort of perverted view that works, good works, obeying the civil ceremonial, you know, all that kind of law in the Old Testament is somehow all tied in together with how a person is saved and especially justified. Mm-hmm. And Paul comes along and he says, no, justification is not a matter of mixing together works of any kind. It doesn't matter how good they might have been. And in fact, if you do that, then you're destroying the gospel. And so he starts off with like this huge condemnation at the beginning of the letter for anybody who's going to preach a different gospel other than this gospel that we're justified, we're declared righteous only by faith in Christ and nothing else. And if anybody adds to that, you know, let him be anathema. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, as I've been going through your book, you know, behind that and kind of, well, I guess interwoven through all this is a very supernatural worldview that Paul has, that he hasn't just placed that on the background and now, okay, we're strictly going to talk about justification by faith, but all of it is mixed together. But can you kind of begin by telling us who were the Galatians? Who were the people that he was talking to? Because you had a fascinating discussion, quoting from Josephus and where these Galatians came from, or actually where they went to and who they became. But can you start us off with who were the Galatians?
These are people that seem to have migrated from farther from the east into that region. And it's I don't know that it's as much the people themselves as it is kind of the history of the place, which is so strange. Mm-hmm. And that's the supernatural part of this, that when I was writing the book, I thought, you know, this is kind of a contribution that I have that might be a little bit unique. Part of it's because of the study that I did with the giants, and that I was just coming off of that, and I was really in tune with the supernatural, you know, worldview that we find in the Bible. And I was really kind of frustrated with the kind of almost the naturalism that I find in so much contemporary Christianity. Like, we've just dumped a lot of the supernatural things that are in the Bible. We no longer really understand some of the links, you know, to the supernatural world. We de-supernaturalize them. And I think some of that's going on here at the very beginning. So the strange thing is that this was a land that the traditions say that that the giants, when they were being kicked out of like the land of Israel mm-hmm. and other places around the Middle East, they actually fled to Galatia. And then, they started fighting with the Romans and they had to flee farther and farther into the outskirts of the known world. So they go up to like France and Germany, and then they get kicked out of there. They go up into England and up into Ireland, which we talked about last time.
Yeah.
It's on your show. So these people were like, they would have known the stories. They would have known the myths of the Greeks and they would have taken them up more seriously than we certainly take them in the modern day. And Paul, at the very least, is playing off some of that. But I think it also he's getting some of his strong language from the supernatural story that I suppose we'll end up talking about during this program. Mm.
I did find it interesting that you as you were quoting Josephus, one of the things about a Kindle books is you can't say what page it's on. All you get are the location.
Right.
makes it a little more difficult. But you talk about Josephus in this first chapter, and he says, Josephus said, Galatia takes its name from the Gauls or the Celts. I just found that fascinating, being where we are here in Ireland, that here you have a connection
exactly.
between these individuals or this people in what's now Turkey, modern-day Turkey, but they are kind of the background history to the ancestors of the Celtic people.
Wasn't there something like a meaning of milky white or something
that's
like that?
That's right, because the Greek word gala means milk, and so it was you had here that these were these milky white, tall, blonde people who lived at the in Galatia.
Yeah, and that's actually that's part of the going back to like the Amorites. You can mm-hmm. read this in Egyptian texts. That they describe them the same way. So this is what Og was of Bashan and mm-hmm. King Sion. They were Amorite kings. And then, then you find them fleeing up farther north. And so you get the same kind of descriptions of the people.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to continue talking with Doug Van Dorn about his book on Galatians. But we're going to go to our second song now, which is by Chris Tomlin, called How Great Is Our God.
The splendor of a king, clothed in majesty, let all the earth rejoice, all the earth rejoice. He wraps himself in light, and darkness tries to hide. It trembles at his voice, trembles at his voice. How great is our God? Sing with me, how great is our God? And all will see how great is our God? Age to age,
You know, Doug, one of the things that you mentioned in your book was Paul's use of angels in the book as a whole, but particularly I just want to focus on in that first chapter where Paul writes, beginning in verse 8, "But even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to the one we preach to you, let him be accursed." Now, you know, some people might say, okay, well, Paul's trying to make a point here, and so he's using hyperbole, but you don't really see it as hyperbole. Paul really, literally, is referring to an angel coming and preaching something different than what he himself had preached to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the tradition that you find in the ancient world, that the sons of God, you know, kind of were the civilizers of humanity, and that they, you know, brought law to us. And this actually becomes an important part of the argument later in chapter 3, where he talks about the law being delivered on Mount Sinai through angels, and then also through a mediator, which the mediator doesn't seem to fit what Moses is, because it seems to be a mediator between angels and God, which Moses wouldn't fit that. So, you know, you've got this just weird stuff going on with these beings that are, you know, delivering messages and stuff. And it also kind of reminds me of other places in the New Testament where Paul talks about like the doctrine of demons and those sorts of things. So, you know, I'm not sure I know how those things were communicated.
Right.
You know, it's like through an oracle or, you know, direct intervention. I have no idea. I've never had that kind of an experience, but I certainly believe that Paul is doing more than just being hyperbolic in his language.
Yeah. So do you think that it was the experience among, if not some in Paul's day, that at least in his history, I guess outside of his use in Galatians 3:19 there, that angels would come and, I don't know, if preaching a false gospel is the right idea here, but come and they're communicating with individuals.
Right. I mean, so in Paul's day, this stuff didn't seem to be going on in the literature that we have the same way that it was in like the really old literature, more Abraham's time or even before that. Mm-hmm. So I'm not, like I said, I'm not sure that the Galatians would have thought that an angel came into their presence, but they might've thought that, you know, I just don't know. But, the clear message is that Paul thinks that, supernatural beings are certainly capable of delivering messages that people can believe and buy into. And his point is that if anybody's going to preach any kind of a message, whether it's a man or an angel, that's contrary to the one that he delivered to them. You know, and he goes right into the Judaizers and their circumcising. So, right. You know, so he's not saying that necessarily an angel came and did this, but, you know, in person, but maybe these guys are in right. league with one. I don't know.
Doug, you mentioned the use of an oracle there. Do you think that has something to do with this as well? You know, like possession by a demon of a person and delivering an oracle in that sense?
Boy, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think about the language of, I think it's in early chapter 3, maybe verse 1. He talks about the people being bewitched. He uses this really weird word that almost, like, we get the word basilisk from it, which is like the evil eye. If you've seen Harry Potter and the basilisk, the things that it can do. Or
right, okay.
You think about Medusa and her look, and it turns people to stone. You know, that's certainly supernatural. In terms of, you know, what he says that's going on, there's some kind of demonic, you know, veiling of the eyes, or, you know, causing people to believe something. I don't know that they were having, you know, going into trances or anything like that. That's not a very Jewish thing to do, but oracles are strange things. I don't know that there's an oracle in the book of Galatians, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, chapter 3 is a very interesting, opening few verses there when he says, "Oh, foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you?" And yeah, that word there, bewitched, so that we translate as bewitched, seems to have a reference to giving the evil eye. Right. And what I find interesting is Paul seems to be playing off of that in that verse, because he says, you know, who has given you the evil eye? And then the next clause, he says, it was before your eyes that Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified. And so he kind of seems to be making a play off this this idea of, you know, has somebody bewitched you, put you under their spell by giving you the evil eye, yet your eyes have seen Jesus publicly portrayed as crucified.
Yeah, that's just such a great insight that you're looking at there. And you know, you think about how was Jesus portrayed as crucified to their eyes. It wasn't literally through, you know, the eyeball, the physical eyeball. Mm-hmm. It was through the proclamation of Christ through preaching to them. So, you know, that gives you the idea that maybe the bewitching, it's not like somebody's looking at them with a Medusa eye, but mm-hmm. they're giving a, you know, they're giving a message that, you know, has a power that is, you know, analogous to the power of the gospel, but it's in an evil way.
Mm-hmm. What I found interesting is I was just studying and preparing, going over this particular book, is that when my wife and I went on our honeymoon, we went to Turkey, and one of my aunts lives in Turkey, and she gave my wife a bracelet, and on it was a little eye, and that eye was supposed to ward off evil eyes.
Oh, wow.
And so it's just fascinating to me that, you know, all these thousands of years later, this same concept is still there in old Galatia, in Turkey.
Yeah, in the very same place. That's wild.
Yeah, that the evil eye is still there. And so they needed another eye to ward it off, which I just thought was fascinating. Really quick, before we go to our ad break, I wanted to ask you, back in chapter one, as we're looking at the, you know, the angel who comes and preaches a different gospel, you know, before he gets to that, he says to the Galatians in verse 6, I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. Could you maybe just talk really quickly about this idea of deserting or abandoning? Because you had a very interesting discussion in your book on just connecting it to various things from, again, the Old Testament, kind of what we talked about last time in the last interview.
Yeah, and bring up a word like this, or bewitched or whatever, these are words that Paul seems to be using to, you know, at the very least play off of the supernatural stuff that he's talking about, if not, you know, making even a stronger point through them than just a word play.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we read that word turning away and or deserting, we think it's just like a turning away from.
Mm-hmm.
But the word, you know, is used in the Old Testament to like talk about being abandoned in a way that that might remind, you know, at least the Jewish Hebrew speakers there, which are the people that he's really talking to, which makes it even more interesting.
Yeah.
That, you know, he's using language that would remind them of the Genesis 6 event and the Gibberim, the fallen Nephilim.
Yeah.
The word to desert actually comes from the word nephal, so, or it translates it. So when they're seeing that, you know, and it's one word might not do it, but if he starts piling words on top of each other that are all kind of going back to the same idea, then they're gonna get the message in a way that we wouldn't.
Right. Yeah, I just found it fascinating. Yeah, you're right, just kind of that very same thing. You say, for example, I found it curious that the Old Testament word to desert is nafal, which is used to describe the fallen Gibberim in Ezekiel 32:27, and they are laid with the giants that fell of old who went down to Hades with their weapons of war. Or take this one, the New Testament word for a desert is eremos, a word possibly borrowed from Mount Hermon, at the base of which was the worship of Pan, the son of Hermes. And so there just seems to be all lexical and maybe etymological relationships between these fallen giants and you know, what he's bringing up here to these Galatians.
Exactly, and I think he does the same thing with the word anathema, like just you know, one or two verses later.
Mm.
It reminds people of that word would remind people of Mount Hermon and the fall of the Watchers. That's the word that it's translating there. So it's more than just being excommunicated, which is bad enough, right. Or eternally condemned, which is bad enough. It's that you're actually relating the sin here of preaching a false gospel to the fall of, you know, the watchers in Genesis chapter 6, when you're using a word like that. Mm-hmm. That's where it comes from. To be devoted to destruction is the, you know, that's the Karem, the, you know, the holy wars that Moses was commanded and Joshua was commanded to undertake in order to get rid of the giants that were in Canaan.
Mm. Well, we will be back to talk more with Doug Van Dorn, but we are going to hit our ad break right now, so we will be back right after this.
Heart of the Matter is brought to you by Dundalk Christian Counselling Centre. This free counselling service is situated at Dundalk Baptist Centre on RT Terrace. You can contact us in complete confidence on 932-7094 or email us at christiancounselling@aircom.net. You can also visit our website at dundalkbaptistchurch.org/counselling.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to Heart of the Matter on Dundalk FM 97.7. My name is Michael Amati. I will be joined by Kevin here shortly, and I'll also be joined by another guest in just a moment, and his name is Doug Van Dorn. He's written a book on the book of Galatians, and we're going to be interviewing him and talking about what is this book about and what can we learn from this book that Paul has written. But before we get to that interview, we want to start with a song by Matt Redman, called 10,000 Reasons. It's a new day dawn. It's time to sing your song again. Whatever may pass and whatever lies before me, let me be singing when the evening comes. Bless the Lord. Well, Doug, let me again thank you for joining us here today and talking about your Galatians book. Right now on the program, we're actually going through the book of Galatians. And so that's why I thought it would be really interesting to bring you on, as I've been using your book to study and to prepare for this these programs. But can you tell us just really quickly how this book came about?
I preached through Galatians, I don't know, it's probably been six or seven years ago, I suppose. Mm. And so I manuscripted out all my sermons, and there was interest in me putting these together for a book. So that's what I just decided to do, is just take what I had preached and put them down for people to be able to read them. So.
Okay, great. Great. Can you start us off by telling us what is the overall argument Paul is trying to make in the book of Galatians?
Well, there's this group of people that are in modern day Turkey that have become Christians, and there were, you know, in most of the churches that he went to, he had a mixture of Jews and Gentiles. So most of the, you know, the natives that are there are going to be the Gentile Christians, but because the Jews are scattered around the world in, you know, the times of the persecutions and things like that when James was written, and Galatians isn't too far away from that point in time, mm-hmm. These Jews were, you know, converting, and that there seems to have been, you know, a large number of the rabbis, kind of the priests that had been scattered around as well. I think this is kind of what the book of Hebrews is about as well. Mm. And anyway, they seem to have had a pretty difficult time losing some parts of, I guess, the ceremonial aspects of what it meant to be a national Jew. And so they started foisting this on the Gentile Christians, especially the idea of circumcising their kids. And this seemed to have been working together with some sort of perverted view that works, good works, obeying the civil ceremonial, you know, all that kind of law in the Old Testament is somehow all tied in together with how a person is saved and especially justified. Mm-hmm. And Paul comes along and he says, no, justification is not a matter of mixing together works of any kind. It doesn't matter how good they might have been. And in fact, if you do that, then you're destroying the gospel. And so he starts off with like this huge condemnation at the beginning of the letter for anybody who's going to preach a different gospel other than this gospel that we're justified, we're declared righteous only by faith in Christ and nothing else. And if anybody adds to that, you know, let him be anathema. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, as I've been going through your book, you know, behind that and kind of, well, I guess interwoven through all this is a very supernatural worldview that Paul has, that he hasn't just placed that on the background and now, okay, we're strictly going to talk about justification by faith, but all of it is mixed together. But can you kind of begin by telling us who were the Galatians? Who were the people that he was talking to? Because you had a fascinating discussion, quoting from Josephus and where these Galatians came from, or actually where they went to and who they became. But can you start us off with who were the Galatians?
These are people that seem to have migrated from farther from the east into that region. And it's I don't know that it's as much the people themselves as it is kind of the history of the place, which is so strange. Mm-hmm. And that's the supernatural part of this, that when I was writing the book, I thought, you know, this is kind of a contribution that I have that might be a little bit unique. Part of it's because of the study that I did with the Giants, and that I was just coming off of that, and I was really in tune with the supernatural, you know, worldview that we find in the Bible. And I was really kind of frustrated with the kind of almost the naturalism that I find in so much contemporary Christianity. Like, we've just dumped a lot of the supernatural things that are in the Bible. We no longer really understand some of the links you know, to the supernatural world. We de-supernaturalize them. And I think some of that's going on here at the very beginning. So the strange thing is that this was a land that the traditions say that the giants, when they were being kicked out of like the land of Israel and other places around the Middle East, they actually fled to Galatia. And then, they started fighting with the Romans, and they had to flee farther and farther into the outskirts of the known world. So they go up to like France and Germany, and then they get kicked out of there. They go up into England and up into Ireland, which we talked about last time.
Yeah.
It's on your show. So these people were like, they would have known the stories. They would have known the myths of the Greeks, and they would have taken them up more seriously than we certainly take them in the modern day. And Paul, at the very least, is playing off some of that. But I think it also he's getting some of his strong language from the supernatural story that I suppose we'll end up talking about during this program. Mm.
I did find it interesting that you as you were quoting Josephus, one of the things about a Kindle books is you can't say what page it's on. All you get are the location.
Right.
makes it a little more difficult. But you talk about Josephus in this first chapter, and he says, Josephus said, Galatia takes its name from the Gauls or the Celts. I just found that fascinating, being where we are here in Ireland, that here you have a connection
exactly.
between these individuals or this people in what's now Turkey, modern-day Turkey, but they are kind of the background history to the ancestors of the Celtic people.
Wasn't there something like a meaning of milky white or something
that's
like that?
That's right, because the Greek word gala means milk, and so you had here that these milky white, tall, blonde people who lived at in Galatia.
Yeah, and that's actually that's part of the going back to like the Amorites. You can read this in Egyptian texts. That they describe them the same way. So this is what Og was of Bashan and King Sion. They were Amorite kings, and then you find them fleeing up farther north, and so you get the same kind of descriptions of the people.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to continue talking with Doug Van Dorn about his book on Galatians, but we're going to go to our second song now, which is by Chris Tomlin, called How Great Is Our God.
The splendor of a king, clothed in majesty, all the earth rejoice, all the earth rejoice. He wraps himself in light, and darkness tries to hide. It trembles at his voice, trembles at his voice. Age to age extends,
You know, Doug, one of the things that you mentioned in your book was Paul's use of angels in the book as a whole, but particularly I just want to focus on in that first chapter where Paul writes, beginning in verse 8, "But even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to the one we preached to you, let him be accursed." Now, you know, some people might say, okay, well, Paul's trying to make a point here, and so he's using hyperbole, but you don't really see it as hyperbole. Paul really, literally, is referring to an angel coming and preaching something different than what he himself had preached to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the tradition that you find in the ancient world, that the sons of God, you know, kind of were the civilizers of humanity, and that they, you know, brought law to us. And this actually becomes an important part of the argument later in chapter 3, where he talks about the law being delivered on Mount Sinai through angels, and then also through a mediator, which the mediator doesn't seem to fit what Moses is, because it seems to be a mediator between angels and God, which Moses wouldn't fit that. So, you know, you got this just weird stuff going on with these beings that are, you know, delivering messages and stuff. And it also kind of reminds me of other places in the New Testament where Paul talks about like the doctrine of demons and those sorts of things. So, and I'm not sure I know how those things were communicated.
Right.
You know, it's like through an oracle or, you know, direct intervention. I have no idea. I've never had that kind of an experience, but I certainly believe that Paul is doing more than just being hyperbolic in his language.
Yeah. So do you think that it was the experience among, if not some in Paul's day, that at least in his history, I guess outside of his use in Galatians 3:19 there, that angels would come and, I don't know, if preaching a false gospel is the right idea here, but come and they're communicating with individuals.
Right. I mean, so in Paul's day, this stuff didn't seem to be going on in the literature that we have the same way that it was in like the really old literature, more Abraham's time or even before that. Mm-hmm. So I'm not, like I said, I'm not sure that the Galatians would have thought that an angel came into their presence, but they might have thought that, you know, I just don't know. But the clear message is that Paul thinks that supernatural beings are certainly capable of delivering messages that people can believe and buy into. And his point is that if anybody's going to preach any kind of a message, whether it's a man or an angel, that's contrary to the one that he delivered to them, you know, and he goes right into the Judaizers and their circumcising. So, you know, so he's not saying that necessarily an angel came and did this, but, you know, in person, but maybe these guys are in league with one. I don't know.
Doug, you mentioned the use of an oracle there. Do you think that has something to do with this as well? You know, like possession by a demon of a person and delivering an oracle in that sense?
Boy, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think about the language of, I think it's in early chapter 3, maybe verse 1. He talks about the people being bewitched. He uses this really weird word that almost, like, we get the word basilisk from it, which is like the evil eye. If you've seen Harry Potter and the basilisk, the things that it can do, or you think about Medusa and her look and it turns people to stone. You know, that's certainly supernatural. In terms of, you know, what he says that's going on, there's some kind of demonic, you know, veiling of the eyes, or, you know, causing people to believe something. I don't know that they were having, you know, going into trances or anything like that. That's not a very Jewish thing to do, but oracles are strange things. I don't know that there's an oracle in the book of Galatians, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, chapter 3 is a very interesting opening few verses there when he says, "Oh, foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you?" And yeah, that word there, bewitched, so that we translate as bewitched, seems to have a reference to giving the evil eye. Right. And what I find interesting is Paul seems to be playing off of that in that verse, because he says, you know, who has given you the evil eye? And then the next clause, he says, it was before your eyes that Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified. And so he kind of seems to be making a play off this this idea of, you know, has somebody bewitched you, put you under their spell by giving you the evil eye, yet your eyes have seen Jesus publicly portrayed as crucified.
Yeah, that's just such a great insight that you're looking at there. And you know, you think about how was Jesus portrayed as crucified to their eyes. It wasn't literally through, you know, the eyeball, the physical eyeball. Mm-hmm. It was through the proclamation of Christ and preaching to them. So, you know, that gives you the idea that maybe the bewitching, it's not like somebody's looking at them with a Medusa eye, but mm-hmm. they're giving a, you know, they're giving a message that, you know, has a power that is, you know, analogous to the power of the gospel, but it's in an evil way.
Mm-hmm. What I found interesting is I was just studying and preparing, going over this particular book, is that when my wife and I went on our honeymoon, we went to Turkey, and one of my aunts lives in Turkey, and she gave my wife a bracelet, and on it was a little eye, and that eye was supposed to ward off evil eyes.
Oh, wow.
And so it's just fascinating to me that, you know, all these thousands of years later, this same concept is still there in old Galatia, in Turkey.
Yeah, in the very same place. That's wild.
Yeah, that the evil eye is still there. And so they needed another eye to ward it off, which I just thought was fascinating. Really quick, before we go to our ad break, I wanted to ask you, back in chapter 1, as we're looking at the, you know, the angel who comes and preaches a different gospel, you know, before he gets to that, he says to the Galatians in verse 6, I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. Could you maybe just talk really quickly about this idea of deserting or abandoning? Because you had a very interesting discussion in your book on just connecting it to various things from, again, the Old Testament, kind of what we talked about last time in the last interview.
Yeah, and bring up a word like this, or bewitched or whatever, these are words that Paul seems to be using to, you know, at the very least play off of the supernatural stuff that he's talking about, if not, you know, making even a stronger point through them than just a word play.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we read that word turning away and or deserting, we think it's just like a turning away from.
Mm-hmm.
But the word, you know, is used in the Old Testament to like talk about being abandoned in a way that that might remind, you know, at least the Jewish Hebrew speakers there, which are the people that he's really talking to, which makes it even more interesting.
Yeah.
That, you know, he's using language that would remind them of the Genesis 6 event and the Gibberim, the fallen Nephilim.
Yeah.
The word to desert actually comes from the word nephal, so, or it translates it. So when they're seeing that, you know, and it's one word might not do it, but if he starts piling words on top of each other that are all kind of going back to the same idea, then they're gonna get the message in a way that we wouldn't.
Right, right. Yeah, I just found it fascinating. Yeah, you're right, just kind of that very same thing. You say, for example, I found it curious that the Old Testament word to desert is nafal, which is used to describe the fallen Gibberim in Ezekiel 32:27, and they are laid with the giants that fell of old who went down to Hades with their weapons of war. Or take this one, the New Testament word for a desert is eremos, a word possibly borrowed from Mount Hermon, at the base of which was the worship of Pan, the son of Hermes. And so there just seems to be all these lexical and maybe etymological relationships between these fallen giants and you know, what he's bringing up here to these Galatians.
Exactly, and I think he does the same thing with the word anathema, like just you know, one or two verses later.
Mm.
It reminds people of that word would remind people of Mount Hermon and the fall of the Watchers. That's the word that it's translating there. So it's more than just being excommunicated, which is bad enough, right. Or eternally condemned, which is bad enough. It's that you're actually relating the sin here of preaching a false gospel to the fall of, you know, the watchers in Genesis chapter 6 when you're using a word like that. Mm-hmm. That's where it comes from. To be devoted to destruction is the, you know, that's the Karem, the, you know, the holy wars that Moses was commanded and Joshua was commanded to undertake in order to get rid of the giants that were in Canaan.
Mm. Well, we will be back to talk more with Doug Van Dorn, but we are going to hit our ad break right now. So we will be back right after this.